This podcast was prepared or accomplished by Dylan Weller and Jonathan Kovacs in their personal capacity. Any views or opinions expressed or represented in this podcast are personal and belong solely to the podcast host and their guests. They do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the host or guest may or may not be affiliated or associated with in a professional or personal capacity. Any views or opinions are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, or individual. The names, dates, or personal details may have been changed or removed to protect confidentiality.
Well, we were out on a couple day check ride. It was the RTL check ride for Jerome, getting a 51 guy. Saw someone wearing their 51 shirt, and Carl Pouliot was the third man. And we were flying on like the Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday was the plan. Do some training. We're on standby Tuesday. Fly up to Quebec for a big mass casualty training exercise with Casera, a big joint operation was the plan. So we transited like Tuesday night, stayed in the hotel. Wednesday morning, we got up to go do the mass casualty exercise with the Quebec police, their Casera teams, which is a civilian search and rescue up there. They're called Sarah Beck. Okay. And some JRCC people.
And sorry, you were flying on the Griffin or the Hercules?
Yeah, we were on the Griffin.
Okay.
So it was his RTL checkered on the Griffin. And so, yeah, we went up there to do that. And then the morning of, the weather was looking really crummy. So we kind of played around to try to get into the training site, but it was in a valley and the weather was socked in. So we turned back and we went back to the airport and we're kind of like, oh, we'll wait for weather and get another bag of gas so we can try again. And at that point, there had been a missing person in the water overnight. And the Slash crew actually ended up coming up, and their helicopter was also in Quebec. So they were doing crew rest at that time. And Bagaville was also set to join the training exercise, and they tried to make it down to Quebec, but because of the weather, they had to turn back, and they got retasked for the search, but couldn't make it. So we ended up going from a training crew on the Wednesday to searching for this PIW, and then we basically missed the training exercise. So we had been planning for a couple of days, okay, how we're going to approach this mass casualty with these patients, two plane crashes. So it was always kind of like our mental rehearsals and our workup, which turned out we worked all day and everyone was tired. So we said, there's no point of pushing it and heading back to Trenton tonight. Let's stay the night. And then we'll fly back on Thursday as a standby crew. So we weren't even supposed to be the crew, but because we're transiting, we said, we'll take the shift. So we started flying back Thursday morning, and you know, it's a couple stops to get from Quebec to back to Trenton. So we're transiting basically along the 401, just north of the 401, and we were 30 minutes back from Trenton. It was like 3:30, I think it was, and we got tasked by JRCC for a plane crash in it's called South River Sundridge area. So we, started doing the calculations of what fuel we needed to get there. And it was going to be a 30-minute flight to Bancroft Airport where we could fuel up. And then from Bancroft, it would be a hop, a 40-minute transit to the crash site. It was just off the runway at the airport. The plane had apparently gone into the woods. We didn't really get a lot of information from JRCC. I'm sure they were pretty busy. And our HERC, at the time, our HERC was broken. It was red for whatever reason. So the guys were on the ground in Trenton and we knew there was no HERC support at this time. So we made a plan. We started thinking about what we're going to do, trying to find out how many people on board, and they didn't know at the time. So we got the information of what type of airplane it was, the ELT that was going off. So we searched that up and saw that it was a maximum of 4-seater. So we started prepping mentally for, we got 4 people. There's 3 of us, so let's make a plan to go through that. We kind of pulled out the protocol book and went over the trauma, the different trauma ones that we'd have, stable trauma, unstable, burns, stuff like that. And we just kind of went through of whose job was going to do what, who's going to carry what equipment down and how the sequence is going to go. Knowing we'd have a fuel stop in Bancroft and talk about it then. So we got to Bancroft. It's like a little small airport where there's like a key on a lockbox. You can basically just like unlock it, flip a switch inside and fuel the helicopter up yourself.
Oh, wow.
So we got there and I just talked to the FE and I said, let us know. We had all the extra gear. We had all our diving gear, like all our water work gear. All we had Carl. We had an extra guy. So we're like, let's see what we need to take off here. So said, let's strip, leave anything behind that we don't need for the mission and get us enough fuel so that when we get there, we got lots of time and we're going to be ready to hoist as soon as we get on scene. So we're not trying to delay for being overweight. So the FE did his calculations. We took some gear off. He asked, you know, how much taking off? Okay, 300 pounds. We'll turn that into fuel. We stashed it in the airport and started converting some bags so we could set up some medical equipment. So then we had the 40-minute transit out to the airport. En route to the airport, we heard that the Herc had been launched from Trenton. So they got it fixed. They got a waiver to get it up in the air. So it was about 30 minutes delay from the tasking for them to get approval. I guess the CEO went to the wing commander and they got the required approval to get the Herc up moving. So they were on scene about 10 minutes before us. And we heard that some other fire and EMS has started showing up at the airport. So as we could approach the airport, we could see the Herc orbiting the head and they had a C8 smoke marker, an orange indicator already dropped out. So we knew where the crash was located.
That's perfect.
And they were talking about jumping. So we could hear them on the radio and they were talking about the Star Techs were dressed and ready to jump. And we knew they also had pre-approval from GRCC to jump. So we're like, hey, we're going to turn left and stay out of your way. Do a little orbit and make sure you guys can have lots of space to get your jumpers out if they're ready. And they said they were ready. So we were kind of waiting for that to happen. So we turned off and as we got closer, we watched the ramp. We could see the ramp was open and we could see them in their orbit and basically looked at the AC. And I said, if they don't get out on this pass, then we're going to call them off and we're going to go in. So they didn't get out. I guess they were in the back looking and like, where do we jump? It's pretty heavily wooded area. We're going to have to jump to the airport where all the EMS and fire is already. And we're just going to be walking in the woods like everyone else.
Right.
So they stayed out of the way. We went in and did right over directly to the, what was suspected crash site for the lat long that had been passed on from the Herc. We got over there. And we did like one orbit. They gave us a good description from the sky of what it was looking like and where it was. We did a single orbit. Then the second orbit, we saw the crash site and one person was on the ground at the crash site waving. And when we were flying by the airport, we could see that an orange helicopter had landed there. So that's the civilian paramedic critical care flight team that works in Ontario. They don't have a hoist capability at all. So they just had landed at the airport and we weren't sure exactly what they're doing because we didn't have any of this information at the time. We didn't know who was on scene yet. So yeah, we got in the hover and there was a really nice open little like wooded area clear out right by the crash, just off the side. So we weren't blowing wind all over the place. We had briefed, the guys had known and we briefed the sequence that it was going to be a single out myself with the medical kit. And I would go right to the crash site and then Jerome would be the second guy out and he was going to bring the oxygen and some more medical equipment. And he would come right to the crash site and Carl was going to be the last guy out and he would stay there and guide down the stokes and bring the stretcher out. So we did that, moved right into the crash site. As soon as we got there, everyone was rolling into the crash. The fire was just showing up at that time. They had made it. They had been looking for multiple searches. They had been looking at the other end of the runway. They didn't know where this plane was exactly. And they had finally, once the smoke marker got out and there was a civilian ground team that had also identified it. So kind of helped with the smoke, bring everyone's eyeballs onto exactly where the crash was. So they all started, we all basically almost showed up identical time. So the plane was upside down and we noticed that there was two patients stuck inside. So we linked up with the fire department and they had some jaws of life and they were working on the front corner of the plane and they were cutting away some of the structure to try to gain access to the patients. So I went to the other side. I was the first one there from the Sartex because we're waiting for the other two to get on the ground. I went over to the other side and I had access under the wing to the second patient, which I'll refer to as patient number one, because they were the first patient that we actually had access to.
Okay.
So I was able to get access to the patient's head and face and establish a airway with an OPA. And then there was a lot of equipment, like their camping gear was all smushed everywhere and kind of trapping them in the plane. So I pulled all that out and we started to work on extrication for the patient number one. Carl Pouliot showed up and had the Sawzall, while Jerome was on the other side with the fire department directing them and kind of showing them what to cut. It seemed like they weren't very familiar with aircraft, so they didn't really know what and where to cut. So he was helping out on that side. Yeah, so we started cutting. We used the Sawzall to cut away the skin of the plane, peel it back, and Carl started working on that while I coordinated extraction with the helicopter. I knew that we had access to the patient at this point, and as soon as we had cut the seats out and the side of the plane, we were going to have the patient out momentarily, and we wanted the helicopter to extract her immediately. I asked the teams that had moved into the ground what the ground travel was like to get in, how bad it was, and it was about a kilometer and a half to 2 kilometers, they said, and it was quite aggressive, pretty wooded in area. So I elected to extract the patient number one via hoist, and that they would fly directly to the airport, which is, you know, a 2-second flight, basically a 15-second flight. And then we would transfer that patient to the orange helicopter that was there. And that orange helicopter could take them to the hospital. We were also knew our fuel state. We wouldn't have a lot of fuel to fly a patient to the hospital and come back. It would have been a too long of a transit for us. So we dropped, the plan was to pick one patient, drop the patient to orange, and then come back, pick up the second patient, and then go from there. And the second patient would come on our helicopter and we would take that patient to the hospital. So we got the first patient out on the stretcher, splinted for the injuries, pelvic binder, got airway management, started to beg valve mass ventilations, rapid extraction. The helicopter was coming on scene, put the patient in the Stokes, moved to the extraction site, prepped for a single and a Stokes. While Jerome stayed at the site and kept working on extracting the second patient, I was with Carl at the extraction site. He went up and then the patient went up and then I guidelined the patient. They went to the hospital, transferred the patient over to Orange, and then Carl and the Stokes came back and reinserted. So we would have him and the equipment back on scene for patient number two. So we kept on working on cutting patient number two out. We finally gained access to the airway. Same thing, went on OPAs, cut all the seat belts away. We had to cut a couple seats out of the airplane because they were in the way. And patient number two ended up being extracted out the same side as patient number one, which is basically the side that the three Sartex had been working on mostly. Well, the firefighters were using the jaws of life to cut out all the dashboard components that were trapping the legs of patient number two in the plane. So same thing, cut all the seat belts, gained access to the patient's airway and shoulders and face, pulled the patient onto the clamshell, onto the stretcher, and started managing the patient from that point for fractures, injuries, airway, BVM. IGL was inserted, and then the patient went into traumatic arrest at that time, and we stayed on scene for 30 plus minutes working our protocol, VSA protocol, and carried that out. And I told the helicopter to hang back and wait. I knew their fuel was going to be an issue at that point, and we wanted to have them conserve fuel as long as possible. So if we ended up getting pulses back and had the patient ready to, we had the patient ready to move and extract immediately. So the helicopter stayed at the airport, spooled down, and was just waiting for the call to come inbound as required. We had the paramedics on scene with us as well. So they had their monitor on right away, and we had no vital signs really present at that time, and they had no shock advised. So we started CPR rotating through the fire department, and the Sartex managed kind of airway and the overall scene that time. We got the stretcher back from Carl, came back with the Stokes, and we were ready. We had it right beside the patient. So as soon as we got some signs of life, we were going to be able to been working with chainsaws that they had got from their ground team and a path large enough for people to move in and out of the crash site, and eventually got a path large enough for their, I say ATV, but it's like a side-by-side that you can actually strap the Stokes on. Oh, wow. In the back, and yeah, and it clicks in and locks in. So they have a spot for a paramedic to sit in a seat with a seatbelt looking backwards, and the Stokes would be beside with the head and right beside the care provider, and then two people driving. So they ended up having that access for us.
Wow.
Yeah. So I made a couple phone calls. We were doing what we could. We were running our everything as best we could. So IOs and liter fluid, and working to do a couple bilateral needle decompressions. And I called, we had at that point 3 no shocks advised. And I made a couple phone calls to the base doctor to see if there was anything else that they thought we could throw at the patient, or if they wanted to give us any further direction. The paramedics on scene were asking their medical director for permission to discontinue after the 30, or around the 28 minute mark with 3-4 no shocks advised. And we were just, I said, you know what, I want to get a hold of my my medical director and see what they're saying. So I talked to the flight surgeon on base, and they had, we had all agreed at that point it was 5 no shocks advised. We had run the protocol. So they said, yeah, discontinue resuscitation due to the traumatic arrest.
Right.
And we talked to, then we used that time to coordinate with the coroner and talk to see what the coroner wanted, if they wanted the patient to be left on scene or extracted to the hospital. So the police were there the whole time. Basically, they did their investigation, had all their details and the pictures they needed, and they said they were happy to have the patient moved from the field to the airport where the coroner would meet. So we did that, walked out with the patient, all our equipment on the side-by-side back to the airport where our helicopter had shut down at this point and was waiting for us. So yeah, we got back to the airport and waited there. Then once the patient was released to the proper authorities, we packed up our stuff, and we had just enough fuel to get back to Bancroft on what was left. So we transited back to Bancroft Airport, landed there, got all our equipment that we had left behind, refueled, and then headed back to Trenton for the end of the shift. I think we got back at 9:30 or something like that at night. And then her crew was still there, and they helped us clean up all the gear and repack the cargo and get ready for the next shift for tomorrow. So the guys that come in the next morning would have be ready to roll.
Wow. That's a heck of a story. Yeah. You know what, when I hear that story and I think about why SAR is here, and I recently read that first chapter in our SAR book, and they talk about scenarios like this where something happens to a plane and they're only a kilometer away from the airport, and it's very quick to see how inaccessible that is. That you could consider that just as remote as somewhere in the Arctic, and it's a kilometer away, yeah. You know? And so when I think about that, it's like, wow, did we ever give these people like the best chance they were going to get, you know? And I think that's pretty incredible.
When I first heard how many, how close was the airport and a couple other assets were there already, I was like, hey boys, we're gonna prep, but let's be honest, we've got a 30 minute transit, a fuel stop, and another 40 minute transit. Like, I don't know if we're gonna make it. We might get scooped here. Like, someone else is gonna get there first, and they're gonna have access, and they're not gonna need us, even if they don't know they might how useful we would have been on the scene or whatever. They're just gonna be like, hey, you know, they're there, they got them, so you guys can turn back. Yeah. I ended up talking with what happened is we ended up taking one of the AEDs from the fire department, which is, I mean, luckily it was the exact same AED that we have. So we ended up loading in the ATV or whatever. And when we're talking, whose is this? They're like, that's hers. So we said, okay, it looks like ours. Let's take it. So we ended up taking it back, which was the only reason that they tried to reach out to us and contact us, because they wanted to get their equipment back. And they did that. I guess the chief of the fire hall, he was on the ground, or one of the crew chiefs was on the ground for the crash. And he came over to the helicopter and talked to us at the end. And so he wanted to have a debrief, and he ended up putting together the police, on scene commander himself, his fire chief, and the paramedic on scene commander all did a debrief, and they invited me. So I joined that, and just trying to figure out how to work better with those organizations in the area, and what capabilities we can provide to them and what capabilities they can provide to us.
Right.
So yeah, it was really good learning, like, you know, a lot of lessons learned. Unfortunately, both of the patients ended up succumbing to their injuries.
Oh man.
The one patient died. I'm not sure if they died en route or at the hospital after we transferred them to the critical care flight. And then the other one obviously died at scene, right, on the scene. So,
but
yeah, that's the goal.
Yeah. Yeah. To give them the best chance, really. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why when the paramedics were, you know, like, okay, we should call this. It's been 30 minutes. I said, we got lots of people. Like, we're not, the rescuers here are not, nobody's exhausted yet. We got lots of hands that can rotate to the CPR.
Yeah.
And we're going to keep working until we get some. So that's why I want to call the doc and make sure that is there anything else that we can do here? And yeah, it was, you know, like I said, traumatic arrest is one of those things where there's not much left to do.
Right. Wow. Well, thanks for sharing the story. That's what were the biggest takeaways, you'd say, be it medical or operational anyway, or
yeah. Yeah. One of the big things we always talk, and I mean, we always talk about, oh, that's, you know, if you get there an hour or 2 hours after the crash, the patients are going to, you know, they're going to succumb to their injuries. They're going to be gone. Right? Like this traumatic stuff is not really our specialty necessarily, because we don't do it a lot. But I'm a big proponent of that. First of all, I don't want to be the one in the helicopter when it crashes and we are the traumatic patient and we don't have the training to deal with treating our own crew and ourselves.
Right.
I think that we need to be ready to respond to our own personnel. And I mean, like you said, if we fly and land at airports all day long, and that's what we do. So if we're at an airport and another airplane crashes on takeoff or landing, that's the most critical phases of flight. Right then and there. So I think, yeah, being able to respond, knowing your equipment. We just put the Sawzall in the helicopter recently. It's not a piece that's normally carried in the Griffin. I'm sure you know from the Cormorant that is carried in the,
definitely
in the Cormorants, but yeah, the Griffin's really small. It's packed for space. So
I was going to, that was my next question really. It sounds like we're able to get a lot done with the limited space in the smaller helicopter. You know, I feel like the Cormorant, if you have, you know how it is, there's a little bit of space on the shelf, you put something on that space in the shelf. And I think the mindset's slightly different on something like the Griffin.
Yeah. And we were joking around because we were doing that mass casualty up in Quebec. It was like, you know, nine red patients or something like that. So we said, we had the Cormorant, it would be landing. We'd load all the nine people on it and we'd take off and it'd be Endex versus the Griffin. We're like, okay, how are we going to put two people on here? So we had that drill. We've been running that drill a couple for, you know, on Tuesday and Wednesday, we had moved the seats up and moved all the equipment from underneath so we could fit two patients in there. So when we were heading to the crash, we stopped at Bancroft. We reconfigured.
Right.
So we could lift up a patient, pick them up, move them to the spots, seatbelt them down, secure them down, on the board, and then send the Stokes back out for the second patient. If we were the only asset, that would have been, and the patients were able, if we were able to gain access to them right away, that would have been the option. So we're prepping for that. I think, you know, never say never, right? That's the scenario. Anything could happen. So whatever the capability you think you can achieve in that helicopter, you know, like two litter patients and one ambulatory, people think that's crazy. Or how many patients can one SAR-tech take care of? Well, I can guarantee you, like, you can take care of a lot more people in a helicopter going to a hospital than you can stuck on the ground by yourself.
Right.
So the goal is to get them up and moving. So we kind of saw that. At one point I was, you know, working on getting the patient number two out, and the firefighter was, you know, watch out for her legs, watch out for the legs. And I said, hey man, we got bigger problems right now. Like the legs aren't the concern. It's the head, the airway, you know, right. The chest, yeah. Everything else is a big issue that we're concerned about. So I used equipment. I used the seatbelt cutter right off the Triton harness. That was my main tool to cut away all the seatbelts. You know, so knowing your equipment, knowing how to use it, that was huge. Being comfortable with it.
Yeah.
And being comfortable, going do these training exercises. So you're comfortable working with other agencies. Yes. Cause you get there and they looked at, we showed up and they looked at us and said, StarTechs are here. And we were lucky that we had a good crew and we were very, you know, we had been slightly worked up and obviously lots of mental rehearsals for what we were going to do and how we were going to run things on the previous exercise. So yeah, it was great, man. Everyone worked really, really well together. The fire, the paramedics, Orange. I said, okay, everyone listen up. This is what's going to happen. We're going to pick this patient number one up. They're going to go in the helicopter. We're going to fly over to the airport, pass it off to Orange. All the Orange paramedics turned their head and looked at me and said, do you need us to go to our helicopter? Yeah, I need you to go to your helicopter right now and get it ready. Right. We're bringing you a patient in 5 minutes. So they left the woods and they headed over to their helicopter to be ready for access.
Wow. That's that's a great use of resources. That's awesome, man.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's, is there anything else to say about it or we'll kind of leave it there?
Yeah. Yeah. Like we said, it's a crummy outcome at the end of the day. Everyone would like to have a better outcome, but even my wife said, we've been on many searches where we look for days and days and days to find a crashed airplane or days and days and days over the water to never bring a body home. So at minimum, you can give that family closure that they need and not drag it on longer and longer and longer.
Right,
so
of course.
I think that was the benefit that we had to take. You had to take the good away from it because, you know, that's all you can do.
And you gave them a real chance in the circumstances they found themselves in, you know? So
yeah, thanks,
we'll leave that with a rescue.
Rescue.